Okay, so I know we have a lot of visitors here, but the breakneck pace of getting through three big chapters of Matthew, or last class was four chapters, continues today as we're trying to get through Matthew 23, 24, 25. But that's because we are looking at Matthew from a big picture perspective, trying to look at the different sections of the book as a whole. And so Matthew 23 through 25, obviously we're getting towards the end of the book. And this is our last speech of the book, or the last speech section of the book. No surprise, what we'll find out is that there's actually a lot of parallels with this last section, speech 23 through 25, that parallels the first speech, which was the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And so that's some of the fun comparisons and parallels that we can see looking at this section of Matthew. But our fifth speech in the book, all three of these chapters. This is one of those more well-known sections of Matthew, maybe especially the parables in Matthew 25, the parable of the talents, the parable of the sheep and the goats, are just some of the more well-known ones. But these are also difficult texts, and so they may be well-known for being more difficult. If you were to do a lot of reading on this section, they're going to call chapters 24 and 25 the Olivet Discourse. Discourse meaning speech, teaching, and Olivet because Jesus teaches it from the Mount of Olives. But as we'll see here, the in terms of the speech section, the speech section begins back in chapter 23. Okay, so that's just a general overview of these three chapters. And the homework page, we ask these regular questions, look for repeated words or phrases, look for structure or organization, any big ideas, or what are, there's going to be big ideas, what are the big ideas, how does the previous section set this up, and then try to give it a title or a name. Okay, so looking at these three chapters, Matthew 23, 24, 25, any repeated words or phrases that we see in here? Scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. Very good. So we see a lot of that. What chapter in here, 23 or 24 or 25, do we see that repeated over and over again? Scribes and Pharisees and calling them hypocrites. 23, that's really the chapter where it's hitting on that. Let's add to that. What's the word that goes with scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites? The woe to you. Very good. So that's a very clear organization of chapter 23 here. Okay, good. Other repeated words or phrases we see through here. That's probably the most obvious one. Yeah, Brian.
Yeah, very simple one, but you, because it's very
good, very good. Woe to you. Yeah, so woe to you, and then he is kind of directing it, these things. The woe idea, so let's just jump into that. Woe shows up seven or eight times, depending on your translation, in this chapter. We've had woes in Matthew before, and you know, just to clarify from the spelling, this is not like woe, like whoa, like interesting, or hold on there. This is like, woe to you, this is bad, announcing something bad. We've seen that before in Matthew. Woe to you, Bethsaida, Chorazin, and then 18:7 is woe to those through whom temptations come, if you're a temptation to someone else. You can read this a couple different ways. Some people read the woe here as more like accusatory denunciation, right? Like, woe to you, kind of a condemning flavor to it. Some read this more as a, like, I feel bad for you, alas to you. I would lean towards more the first, but there's maybe that sense in it too. And by the end of the chapter, Jesus is saying, I wished I could bless you. You know, I'm like this mother hen that wishes I could gather the chicks under my wings, but you wouldn't have it. You wouldn't have it God's way. So, woes are coming. Bad things are coming. Okay, scribes and Pharisees each get 8 times showing up here in the chapter. They're the ones receiving the woes here. And these are 2 different kinds of religious people. The scribes would be more of a job or a position, maybe kind of like the idea of you're not a rabbi, but you're underneath that. So, you know, you got your bachelor's instead of a master's or PhD or, you know, something, but kind of a job or position. Pharisee was more of a party, like a belief system. And so, you know, that kind of groups people together who believe similar things. Paul refers to the Pharisees as being the most strict of the sects, the parties of the Jewish system there. Okay, other key words we see here. Rhonda.
So he doesn't just say that, he's going to emphasize the details right after that.
Absolutely, yes. And he gives several things to really chew on here. Yeah, Jerry.
One is your teacher, one is your father, one is your leader.
Okay, so this is in verse 7 and following. So you like being called rabbi, but don't be called rabbi because you've got one teacher. Don't call any man on earth your father, because you got one father. Don't call someone an instructor, because you've really got one instructor. And you're like, well, we're calling JD the instructor of this class, right? The teacher of this class. You're not supposed to call him that? Well, I mean, the point is, am I authoritative? Are you really a follower of me, or are you really a follower of Jesus? That's the idea. So if you're going to say, well, JD's my teacher, that's not the idea. You know, you're only... job is to listen to Jesus, that idea. You don't need to find some doctor of the church. You don't need to find some rabbi. You don't need to find someone else to be your go-between. I'm going to listen to them. Fundamentally, I'm just here to listen to Jesus. He's my rabbi. He's my teacher. God is my father, that idea. Okay, very good. Yeah, Justin?
There's a couple of weeping and gnashing sections.
Absolutely. So we're going to see that in chapter... oh, I forget exactly all of where that is. 24, 25, end of 24, weeping and gnashing of teeth. And then 25, 30, outer darkness, weeping and gnashing of teeth. And and we've seen outer darkness already in Matthew. Good. Yeah, Brian.
A couple different ways of words. Take heed and watch things of the one.
Absolutely. Good. Let's see if that's next. Nope, that's not next. Next is hypocrites. So I'll get to that in a second. Maggie? Truly I say to you, and of course we've seen that in Matthew, and Jesus says, listen, that's his way of saying, this is really the truth here, okay? Hypocrites shows up, is another repeated thing with his criticism of the scribes and Pharisees here. We use the word hypocrite to describe someone who preaches one thing but does something else. Okay, so I tell you, don't smoke, and then you find me outside after church. You know, on a smoke break. And you're like, JD, you're being a hypocrite, right? So we use that in kind of a narrow way. I suspect that is part of this. We see that kind of thing in this chapter. It's just that the word hypocrite is broader than that. In the Old Testament, this word is used more generally, impious, godless, profane, lawless. So it's a very strong word, but it's not just because you preach one thing and then do something else. It's a little more generic than that, but still strong, though. Some of the behavior here is, in fact, hypocritical, right? You lay heavy burdens on people, but you're not willing to move them yourself. Some of this here in the chapter is pride, right? Their love of honor. They disregard God's intentions. You have really kind of changed what an oath is when you can wiggle out of it. Oh, I swore by the altar... but no, that doesn't really count. Oh, but if I swore by the gift on the altar, then that would count. Well, you're just, it's like I cross my fingers, so that doesn't really count kind of thing. Neglecting God's true will. Key statement here, so helpful for us. Remember what Jesus said there in Matthew 23:23? The 23:23 helps us remember it. That, you know, they neglect the greater things. They neglect the weightier matters of the law, justice and truth and faithfulness. By pursuing these other things and miss the big things. And so you're so worried about swallowing a gnat, you end up swallowing a camel. Talk about a sense of humor and a vivid illustration there. Okay, Lori? It might, yes, there might be a sense of play acting and a sense of, yes, and it doesn't go deep enough, right? And so it's all this religiosity, but it's not internalized enough, and that's for sure. So I don't think the hypocrite here is that your average scribe and Pharisee was, you know, preaching on the Sabbath, and then that night they're going out and committing adultery. Obviously, things happen. Those kinds of things could happen, but I don't think that's the kind of hypocrite that is being pointed out here. It's more of this religiosity. There is some hypocritical behavior here, and especially they look hypocritical in the sense of they look pious, they look like they're teaching the law, and Jesus says, whoa, they're not. They're not. Don't do what they're doing. They're missing the weightier matters. And so it's that kind of, that's the kind of mask. It's not because they're going out and partying at night, but the mask of they look religious, they look righteous, but they're actually not. Okay. Darren.
They're not taking care of their families. They're using religion to get out of things.
Yep.
So the love is missing, which is the church later. I mean, that's missing
from
their own families. So that would make a serious hypocrite if they don't even care for their own family, how they care for others.
Yeah. Yes. And so this flavor of hypocrisy. Was that?
Miss the boat.
Yes, absolutely. Miss the boat. You're missing the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. And this version of hypocrisy is not, again, on the Sabbath you go and they say, everybody should honor father and mother, and then they like do the opposite of what they just said. It's more the flavor of, well, the law says you don't have to honor your father and mother in this way, or here's how we live this out. And so they're kind of using that religion to justify that kind of thing. They're called blind here four times. Four times they're called blind. Blind guides twice, blind fools. That we've seen that earlier in the book, right? We've seen it Matthew 15:14. Remember what Jesus said back in Matthew 15? Jesus' teachings are so memorable. If the blind lead the blind, both fall into a ditch, right? I remember our two blind men sections back in chapter 20. So we've seen blind a lot here, you know, in the book. Okay, coming of the Son of Man, that phrase shows up 10 times in chapter 24. That's key there. That's really what chapter 24 and 25 are about. In 24, the disciples come and say, when will these things be? What is the sign of your coming and the end of the age? So there it doesn't say the coming of the Son of Man. They say you're coming in the end of the age. But that's really what chapter 24 is about, is the coming of the Son of Man. This generation shows up a couple times. Twice Jesus says it will be this generation that the judgment is coming upon. And then who said this one? Stay awake, watch, be ready. Who was that? Someone said Brian. Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Okay, so yeah. Related things, right? Stay awake, be on the alert, watch, be ready. Often repeated, especially at the end of 24, beginning of 25. You don't know when the master is going to show up, so be alert, be ready for him. You know, you have to be ready. You have to always be ready because you don't know when he's showing up. You don't know the day, you don't know the hour when he is coming. And so be awake, stay alert, keep doing your job kind of idea. Okay, that's all I had for the repeated words or phrases. Anyone else want to add one there? Okay, so then structure or organization. We've already hit on a key, obvious one in chapter 23, which is the repetition of the phrase, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, some variation of that. Okay. Any other structural things? And again, some of these are so obvious, we notice them without thinking, oh, yeah, that's a thing. For example, chapter 25 is three what? What are the three things that really comprise chapter 25? Three parables, right? Oh, yeah. And if you read 25, you notice that. Oh, yeah, three parables. But really, that is a pattern. That is kind of a structure of that chapter. So here's my attempt to organize some of this. Chapter 23 that is the why judgment is coming, right? Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. One preacher compared this. You know how you enter, you know, Cincinnati. No, you enter St. Louis, and it says, you know, Gateway to the West. You know, and you enter Columbus. What's our phrase here? A surprised but memorable, something like that, right? Right? Something like that. Okay. You enter other cities, a nice little, you know, the crossroads of America is Indianapolis, right? So you're entering Jerusalem, you know, it says population 25,000, and underneath it says, the city that kills the prophets and stones those sent to it. You know, that's kind of what Jesus is saying here. It's like, that's how you characterize this city. So in this chapter, verses 1 through 12, don't be like the scribes and Pharisees, right? And then the rest of the chapter, a lot of it is these woes, the seven woes, verses 13 through 36. And then the conclusion there is judgment is coming against Jerusalem. And verse 38 there, your house is left to you desolate. What's a pretty good option of when he says your house, what's the main house of Jerusalem? The temple, right? So your temple is going to be destroyed. Your house is going to be left desolate there. So that's kind of chapter 23 there, an intro and a conclusion, then the seven woes. That one's pretty straightforward. Okay. Chapter 24, the prophecy of the coming of Jesus. You could say the coming of the Son of Man, right? The disciples ask this question in Matthew 24, verse 3. They get to the Mount of Olives. The disciples come privately. They say, when will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming? What will be the sign of the close of the age? I'm not 100% sold on this, but I think it's worth chewing on, considering that is an outline of the chapter. The three questions that they ask there, when will these things be? What's the sign of your coming? What's the sign of the end of the age? Is kind of an outline for the rest of chapter 24. So when will these things be? Is verses 4 through 14. What's the sign of your coming? 15 to 35. And then the sign of the end of the age is 36 to the end. Like I said, I'm not 100% sold, but I think it's pretty good. I think it can be pretty helpful. So that's kind of at least kind of taking an outline from the chapter itself. So I think there's some usefulness to that. And then what did we say is chapter 25? The parables, right? So we got these three parables of the coming of Jesus. Parable of the 10 virgins, parable of the talents, and the parable of the sheep and the goats there. So, you know, we try to make some organization. It's not perfect, but any thoughts that you had on this or structural things that you noticed going on here in this section? Yeah, Brian.
I think a little bit more about 25 is like it's not just three random stories, the parables he's telling, right? It's big washbowl, there's going to be an accounting, and there's going to be a judgment.
Yes.
Sort of progressing as he's going.
Very good, yeah. And you should kind of see that train of thought. So be watchful. The end of 24 says things like, keep feeding the servants, right? Who's the faithful wife servant? Who's doing the job? Blessed is that servant when the master shows up. But if the servant gets wicked and he just starts beating people and getting lazy, then the master's going to show up. Okay, so then that transitions into the five wise virgins and the five foolish virgins. And be ready, be watchful. And then you keep going forward. There's this accounting. I like the way that Brian put that, where God's given you opportunities. Talents is just the worst word. I know we use talent because that's their measure of money. So you think like $1 million. Talent, but we read that and we go, oh, talent. Like, God give me talents. Like, you know, I'm a five-talent guy because, you know, I can type really good and I can, you know, use Microsoft Excel. And I don't know, maybe a couple other talents, you know. I can, you know, groom dogs, like whatever it is, right? You're like, oh, I got to use my talents for God, right? I do groom our dog, which is why I said that. But that's a different thing. That's not one of my, you know, two talents. Okay, that's not the point. Is God's giving you talents? The point is God's giving you opportunities. And so think talent as like $1 million, right? And so God gives one guy $5 million and he expects $5 million afterwards. God gives another guy $2 million and he expects $2 million afterwards. Okay, that idea there. Now, there's a lot of parallels. Oh, yeah, Rhonda?
So you value of a talent today, because I've taught a class on this. Because I gave one of the kids a talent, and gave him one kind of diamond, and he's dying. And he had this talent. I mean, literally, he knows that. I said, but you don't understand. I finished that talent on goal. What it'd be worth today? Today, $5,484,987. You have a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah. So even the one talent guy was given $5 million, right? So it's like, that's enough to invest and get some money back. Absolutely. Okay, so there are many parallels between the first speech, which is the Sermon on the Mount, and the last speech in Matthew. How does the first speech in Matthew 5, 6, 7, how does that begin in a similar way to our final speech here, 23? And the hint there is that Luke puts them together. What did you guys see there? Blessings and woes. That's it. Did you notice that? So here in Matthew 5, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the meek. And Matthew 23, woe to you scribes and Pharisees. And so at the beginning of the first speech is the blessings, the beginning of the last speech is the woes. Okay, Luke, on the other hand, puts it all together here. Blessed are you who are poor, yours is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you who are hungry now. Blessed are you who weep now. Blessed are you when people hate you. But woe to you who are rich. Woe to you who are full. Woe to you who laugh now. Woe to you when all people speak well of you, for so their fathers did to the false prophets. Do you see how that really gives a structure to the book of Matthew, that the first speech has these blessings, the last speech has these woes? And it goes deeper than that, because what is the Sermon on the Mount all about, did we say? The whole first speech is about that theirs is the kingdom of heaven, right? Who's going to get in the kingdom? What's that? Who the citizens of the kingdom are, right? So the first speech, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, are who the citizens are. It's the poor in spirit. It's those who build their house on the foundation of Jesus Christ. Beware of false prophets. That, you know, judge not lest you be judged. Okay, that's all about who the citizens of the kingdom are. Is Matthew 23, 24, 25, this section we're looking at here, is this about who the citizens of the kingdom are? No. What would you say? It's about who's not in the kingdom, right? Who Jesus is coming to punish, right? So the woes. So that's really the idea, is the first speech is the citizens of the kingdom, and the final speech is kind of the judgment, the kingdom coming in judgment idea. So Matthew separates the blessings and the woes to kick off the first and the last speech, but Luke puts them together here. So I think that's cool. I think it's a fun little thing to notice about the book as a whole. Yeah, Brian.
It really is like the whole tone of Matthew as well. The first is those who are coming to Jesus. And then you see the tone of Jesus start to ratchet up as they start to oppose him. He's not backing off, and he's dealing with them directly, but it's okay. If you don't come to me, then this is the opposite side. You just see that in how he's addressing people.
Yeah, yeah. So, the second story section, 8 and 9, are the miracles, right? People coming, people being healed. But then it's, okay, starting to address those who are opposing it, who don't get it, this wicked generation who's rejecting me, that idea. Yeah, Lori.
Maybe I see something else there, but I saw somewhere in Matthew 23 that Jesus said,
Absolutely. No, I think that's alive and well, what you described. So remember that the key statement of the Sermon on the Mount, that kind of the main body of what's going on in the Sermon on the Mount is, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you won't enter the kingdom. And then he goes into all these things, the scribes and Pharisees, they love money. The scribes and Pharisees are judges when they're not supposed to be the judges. Scribes and Pharisees do things to be seen by men. Well, then, that's what we see here. So that criticism of the scribes and Pharisees is alive and well back in the Sermon on the Mount, and it's alive and well here in this. So yes, I think that's a very real connection. Okay, how do both speeches end? End of Matthew 7, end of Matthew 25. How might you describe those scenes? Time of reckoning. What else might you say? Depart from me. Yeah, that's the phrase that's repeated. So Matthew 7, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. The one who does the will of my Father is in heaven. On that day, many will say, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? Cast out demons in your name? Do many mighty works in your name? Then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. So this is sections from the end of Matthew 25. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, all the angels with him, he'll sit on his glorious throne. The king will say to those in his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you. He'll say to those on the left, depart from me, you cursed into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. They will answer, Lord, when we see you hungry or thirsty or stranger. Okay, so in chapter 7, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. Of course, what does Jesus say? Come, inherit the kingdom, right? So come into the kingdom, come inherit it. And then they say, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy? And that's their question that they're asking back in Matthew 7. What's their question that they're asking in Matthew 25? When did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger, right? So similar thing. Lord, what about this? And then the big one that Darla just brought out, Jesus says, depart from me. And that is, same thing, at the end of Matthew 25. So do you see how the first speech, Sermon on the Mount, and the last speech, 23, 24, 25, they begin the same way, blessings and woes, and they end the same way with this scene of judgment. Who is the judge in both of these scenes? Yes, but even more precisely, Jesus, right? The Lord. And Jesus says, depart from me. The Son of Man is sitting on his glorious throne. So both of the speeches end with scenes of Jesus as king, as judge, bringing that judgment in that scenario. Yeah, Darla. And it's not even about these great things we do, right? And so he says, I never knew you. Depart from me. You work lawlessness. And even though we did these great things. And, you know, people could debate, is the focus here in Matthew 25, the sheep and the goats, are these people who were religious? Are these people who thought they knew God? It's hard to know, but you could read it like this. Well, Jesus, I knew about you. And Jesus, if you showed up, I would have done this to help you. And Jesus says, well, no, when you didn't do it to the least of these, right? When you didn't do it to the least of these, then you didn't do it to me. Yeah, Kendra? Oh, absolutely. Good, yeah, that's right. They thought there's a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. Yeah, Darren?
At the cross, we see all this happen to Christ, and he was rejected by all. So it works both ways. It was for other people we aren't helping, but it actually happened to Christ as well. They all forsook him at the cross. He was hungry, he was thirsty, he was clothed. Everything in the picture happened to him before he died.
Yeah, and his disciples abandoned him. Good. Good, yeah, Lori? Ah, very good. Very good. So if we couldn't hear Lori, I never knew you in Matthew 7. Earlier in Matthew 12, truly I say to you, I do not know you, right? So that idea of not having had a relationship, absolutely. Very good. It's supposed to scare us. This is alarming. This is supposed to be sobering. That is absolutely the point of it. So the first and last speeches end with the scene of Jesus as the king judge or the judge king or king and judge. It's the same role. Remember, back then, the king was the judge, right? And so he is king, he's on his throne, and he's bringing his judgment. Brian.
I had a conversation yesterday on the way to a contest. In fact, there's a guy that is one of the type that basically, you know, believes once saved, always saved. These kind of verses are really important because he believes that no matter what you do from that point on, you're fine. And Jesus is saying here very clearly, no, that's not the case. If there's a point where you will no longer be with him, and you're separate.
Yep.
And they're very powerful and very direct and difficult verses for it should be for all of us to agree, but especially for that kind of position.
Yeah, depart from me, I never knew you, you workers of lawlessness. Those three things kind of going together there. They work lawlessness, I never really had a relationship with you, and you know, that's the judgment on them. Certainly, our deeds are crucial. And here, both in Matthew 7 and 25, whether it's chapter 7, you workers of lawlessness, or 25, you didn't do these things to the least of these. And so our works are important. Our deeds are important. Lori. Yeah. So if we're filled up with ourselves, filled up with my image, reputation, my greatness, my righteousness, then I can't be filled up with Christ. It's going to be one or the other. I can't serve two masters. Right. That's right. So it's like your hands can only hold so much. And so when you have filled up your hands, your focus, your life with focus on yourself, your own version of religion, a God in your own image, well, then you don't have room for the real work of the Lord. So, yes, absolutely. Big ideas in this section, God's displeasure with the Jewish leaders of the day. They teach and preach the law, but they don't really live it. It's religious, but it's lawless. They observe the little things, which is good, right? Jesus says, sure, tithe the mint and dill and cumin, good. But they miss the big things, and that's, you know, inexcusable, the weightier matters of the law. And so they're so concerned about accidentally swallowing a gnat, they swallow a camel. And that's an amazing picture. I think the idea there is the gnat would be the smallest unclean animal. The camel would be the, generically speaking, the largest, you know, unclean animal. So you're straining out to make sure you don't swallow any gnats. But the way you're doing that is bringing about your swallowing camels, right? They love the honor. They love doing things to be seen. They put burdens on people they're not willing to bear themselves. We don't have time to jump into this too much, but this is a section of the Mishnah, which was written down 150 to 200 years after Jesus. Theoretically, these would be the kinds of things they were saying in the time of Jesus. We could debate that all day long, but it's at least Jewish documents from rabbinical Judaism here. So if you forget the essence of the Sabbath, you're ignorant, whatever, you're liable to bring only one sin offering for all those labors which you're aware. Now, this is after all these detailed things of what accidentally break or how you can break the Sabbath according to their rules. You know, detailed things. But the point is, okay, you know the essence of Sabbath, but you forget you're liable to bring a sin offering for every Sabbath you become aware. Okay, you're aware of the Sabbath, but you temporarily forget. And if you break multiple Sabbath labor categories, so that's the problem, is you do multiple mistakes, multiple categories. Well, now you have to bring a sin offering for each and every category. But if they're all in the same category, then you only have to bring one sin offering. So you can you know, carry your keys in your pocket in and out of your house 100 times because it's just one thing, and you only have to do one sin offering, but you're still carrying a load on the Sabbath. But if you extinguish a candle and the wick goes from being a wick to being coal, you've created something, which is a creative act on the Sabbath. So now, because you did that and you carried your keys out in your pocket, you have to give two sin offerings. Do you see how, if you're teaching the nice old ladies at the synagogue that this is how you fix all these little mistakes you've made, and you fix all these little mistakes that I'm telling you are Sabbath violations by giving all these sin offerings, do you see how their religion would facilitate what Jesus calls devouring widows' houses? Do you see how, well, it's easy for me because I sit around all day thinking about what's a Sabbath violation, and I debate the other rabbis on what's a Sabbath violation. But you don't know these things, and you've got to fix it with money, with sacrifices. Well, sorry, no, it's multiple Sabbath categories, and so that's going to require multiple offerings. Now, I suspect that this was even worse in Jesus' day, because this is 150 years later, after Jews have been debating Christians for 150 years. And you would assume that some of their more flagrant, outrageous ideas would have been weeded out in the subsequent 150 years. But if this survives into the Mishnah 150 years later, you can see how established that kind of thinking is. Does that make sense? When Jesus says to them, "You tie up heavy burdens, hard to bear, lay them on people's shoulders, but they are not willing to move them with a finger." And so they're fine with the little old ladies selling their house to provide for the sin offerings, but they're fine because I know how to not break the Sabbath. Do you see how that would be a religion that is what Jesus is calling hypocritical here? Yes. That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. So that the book in the Mishnah Shabbat is very long. And right after the 7:2 is a listing of the 39 categories of labor of the different ways you can break the Sabbath. So they had 39 categories for that. And then detailed listings of, you know, how much things are become a violation to carry or not, you know. And, you know, it's all about building a fence around the fence around the fence. So women can't look in the mirror on the Sabbath because they don't have the self-control to not pluck out hairs when they see gray hairs. And so because plucking a hair is a labor on the Sabbath, women shouldn't look in mirrors on the Sabbath, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Yeah, Lori. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, let's flip the script here. Let's say that you think this nice old lady who's been violating the Sabbath for a really long time and doing all the things she didn't realize, she has to pay all these sin offerings, but you're a rich guy, and then you pay it all for her. You give it. Well, that's a lot better, isn't it, right? And you don't end up with the widow in Mark and Luke, tell the story. You don't end up with the widow who's literally giving her last two copper coins to the temple because you're helping her out. She's going to be fine. Well, yeah, she has to pay all these things, but it's okay. I'll help you out here. Whoa, that's very different, and that would receive a lot less condemnation from God, right? I think we can see that. Yeah, Alex?
This verse is so potent for us today still, in my opinion. I mean, this is the one that I come back to a lot.
What verse?
In 23, in chapter 23, in verse 23 and 24. But this idea of neglecting the weightier matters of the law, so the first implication of that to me is that Jesus says, well, there are some most important things, mm-hmm. right? What are the most important things? Is it getting every single thing you do right perfectly? Which is, by the way, can we all admit, that's what we argue the most about sometimes, getting it perfectly right and being as perfect as we possibly can. He says, hey, the things that really matter are justice, mercy, and faithfulness. I'm not saying that it's not important for us to try to get everything as close to how God prescribes as possible. But I do feel like sometimes we get so caught up in that, that it's good to step back and say, Jesus is reminding them here, hey, think about what this whole thing is actually about.
Yeah. Yeah, amen. Amen. I like the definition of perfectionism that says perfectionism is making everything equal, right? And so it's not enough to say, well, I put the greatest effort towards the greatest commands. No, every box is the greatest command. Every box is it. And so that's, I think, a very helpful reframing of these kinds of ideas. Okay, let's move on a little bit more to cover what we can before our time runs out. Big ideas. Judgment is coming. It'll be against that generation, against that city, specifically about 35 years is when Jerusalem will be destroyed. It's coming whether you're ready or not. So be ready, right? Ready or not, here it comes. Ultimately, the judgment of Jesus will be against the whole world. That's how Matthew 25 ends. The whole world, all nations gathered before him, and he'll separate the sheep and the goats. Jesus sees kindness to the little ones as kindness to him, right? The king answered, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me. So, you know, you serve the little ones, you're really serving Jesus. Now, we've seen that in Matthew a lot, right? Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. Whoever receives you receives me. Whoever receives me receives the Father who sent me. Whoever gives one of these little ones a cup of cold water, he'll by no means lose his reward. Okay, how does the previous story section set up this speech? We've been warned about the Jewish leadership killing Jesus, and then we meet them, and now we have Jesus' condemnation, right? So he says in chapter 20, the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and scribes. They'll condemn him to death. And then in 21, we meet them, and the chief priests and scribes reject him. And now we're seeing, you know, the condemnation of them, right? We see Jesus' principles of humility lived out here. In chapter 23, our section, he says, the greatest among you shall be your servant. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled. Whoever humbles himself will be exalted. Did we see that before? We did, right? Many first will be last, last first. Whoever great among you must be your servant. Whoever be first among you must be your slave. Okay. The vivid descriptions of judgment we've seen previously show up here as well. Okay, we've kind of hit on that. Give the section a title, Woes for Jerusalem, the Son of Man is coming back, Jesus brings eternal punishment and eternal life, and then kingdom judgment. So remember, I told you from the beginning, I'm going to summarize all five speeches with kingdom fill in the blank. And so kingdom judgment, I think, is the best way to describe speech five here. And this is kingdom in the sense of the king comes and his dominion and his rule, right? And so the king is coming and he is bringing his rule against Jerusalem in about 35 years. And so remember this from before, the first and the last speech have all these connections. They begin and end the same way, right? How do the first and last speeches begin? Blessings and woes. How did the first and last speech end? Jesus is judging. Jesus judging, depart from me, that whole idea. And so the first speech is people who will be in the kingdom, blessed are the poor in spirit, versus people who will not be in the kingdom, woe to you, you do not enter the kingdom, and you shut the door in people's faces who are trying to get in. Okay, and then some very clear parallels with the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy contains a lot of prophecy about future judgment. I hope you got to see that. Really, Deuteronomy 27 through 32, lots of chapters, lots of texts, is all about judgment, very judgment-focused. It's powerful not because we're necessarily seeing all these Deuteronomy wordings, although I think there's going to be some limited there. It's more that Jesus is the new Moses, right? Moses said, judgment is coming, judgment is coming. You disobey, I'll judge you. If you disobey, I will bring an army and take you out of the land. Did Jesus say the same thing? Yes, Jesus said the same thing. So, I think this is interesting. The person is cursed under the law when they don't treat others well, right? Honor father and mother, don't dishonor the blind, don't mistreat the orphan and the widow, give them justice, right? So there's this curse under the law for mistreatment of others. That sure sounds like the weightier matters of the law, as Alex brought us to, right? And then It sounds like helping the least of your brothers. And when you help the least of your brothers, you're really helping Jesus. And we'll wrap, that's the bell, but let me say this at the end. I always think of my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law has spent years of her life regularly going to women's prisons, teaching them, helping them, going on Sunday with their church services. And Matthew 25 is her favorite passage, and it hangs on the wall in their house there at it, of someone inside the prison, someone outside the prison, and it says, "When you did this to the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me." Always think of my mother-in-law and her prison work along these lines, her favorite verse. Okay, thank you guys so much. Did you get the worksheet? Hopefully you got